Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 154, I chat with innerfidelity.com editor Tile Hertzens about wireless and surround headphones. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded April 8th, 2013, episode 154. It's all in your headphones. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the Home Theater Geek. This week's guest geek is Tile Hertzens, the editor-in-chief of innerfidelity.com, which is a website devoted to all things headphone. Hey, Tile, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Scott. Good to see you again.
You too. You're one of my most frequent guests, and I'm glad to say that because you always have lots of interesting things to say, and everyone in the chat room and who's listening really enjoys your time with us. So thanks so much for being here.
Well, I'm a cheap and easy date, Scott. I pretty much go for just about anything.
Very good. Well, listen, those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Tile as we go along, and I will pass along as many as I can. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about today is something that I get a lot of questions about. Readers and listeners write me all the time wanting to know about wireless headphones. And, you know, they want to plug it into their DVD player. Even Leo got a couple questions about it this last weekend on the Tech Guy radio show. You know, somebody wanted to plug some sort of transmitter dongle thingamabob into their DVD player, Blu-ray player, and be able to listen to their Bluetooth headphones. And a lot of other people ask about wireless headphones, too. What can you tell us about, is wireless any good? Does it reach the quality of wired in any way, or are we just barking up the wrong tree there?
You know, they're getting better all the time. Bluetooth is improving with app decks and a whole variety of things. For home theater installations, I'd recommend the kind of wireless headphones that have a base station that you hang the headphones on to charge them. I find Sennheiser really does the best job there. Sennheiser is very, very consistent in terms of sound quality, for starters. And then they do a really good job on their transmission schemes. They have some spread spectrum FM units.
Say that three times fast.
Yeah, probably not. RS-110 and RS-120, those are the lesser expensive versions of their headphones, which are quite good. They're in the $100 to $200 range. And then the RS-170 and 180 are really terrific. They're kind of my favorite in their line. The RS-170 is a sealed unit. It has, I think it has DTS surround in it, which is okay. I prefer the Dolby headphone, but I think it's quite expensive for licensors, so it tends not to show up as much as I'd like to see it. The RS-170 is also a sealed headphone, so you can lay in bed at night and whoever's in bed with you won't be able to hear very well, or it will be pretty low if they do hear it at all. Then there's an RS-180, and that one is an open version, which sounds a little bit better. It doesn't have the surround mode, but it does have a compression circuit so that it equalizes the levels on TV when you go to commercials and so on. Although I've heard that they're supposed to stop raising the level on commercials. Have you heard anything about that, Scott? Have they stopped?
Yeah. Well, I have. The Congress even got into the act and passed something called the CALM Act. I don't remember what that stands for now. Somebody in the chat room will be able to tell me for sure. CALM, which is supposed to legislate that commercials aren't, you know, can't be louder than the program content.
Right.
But, you know, right. We're on a little bit of a sidetrack here, but I will tell you the result of a little anecdotal research I did on this very subject, which is I took a sound level meter and I measured the level of a half hour Simpsons episode, I think. This was some time ago, and I measured just the entire half hour, which included the commercials. And then I looked at the levels for every minute of that half hour. This is a very sophisticated sound meter, and it can log the different levels and metrics every minute of the period of time that you measure. And what I found was very interesting. The level of the commercials did not exceed the highest level in the program, in the Simpsons television show. What the difference was that the commercial level stayed at the high level throughout the entire commercial, whereas in the television show, you have a much greater dynamic range. It dropped down quite a bit more than coming back up. So it's not that commercials are louder, at least in this one instance, not louder than the TV show. It's just that they stay at that peak level. And so they appear to be, they seem to be louder.
So they're compressed and then put up again at the peak, whatever the peak level is being allowed.
Right.
Yeah. Right. So exactly. They're going to get around it one way or another.
Yes, exactly right.
Commercials will be obnoxious.
Right. Exactly. Reverb Mike in the chat room is saying dynamic processing, smash the dynamic range without raising the volume, makes your ad pop. And that's exactly what they're doing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, anyway, getting back to the issue of wireless headphones, I know that our engineer John was interested in this particular subject because he wants to put in a system at the Twit Brick House where you have one transmitter sending to several different headphones at once. And the reason for that is, during the radio show on the weekends with Leo, sometimes people come in and they need to be wearing headphones in order to hear the show. Yeah. And at the moment, it's wired headphones. And so you got these wires dangling across the studio. And he wanted to try and implement something wireless. And I believe you said you did have one potential solution for that, but with a caveat.
Well, in fact, to the best of my knowledge, all the Sennheiser wireless headphone systems in their entire range, and I would say there's probably six of them, will run multiple headphones from the same transmitter. So you can have as many headphones as you'd like, on the on the less expensive units. And then once you get up to the 170 and 180, because they use clear, I think there's a limit using clear to six receiver units. So you can use up to six headphones for sure on the higher end Sennheiser units. The only problem is the base station has a little hanger on it that you put the headphones on, and that's how the headphones charge. So you have to charge the headphones one at a time if you only had one base station. I suppose you could use the base stations at the chargers. But at any rate, you could certainly do that. The Sennheiser headphones would work for that, no problem.
Now, what is the technology that Sennheiser is using? Because there are several. You could do IR, infrared. You could do RF, as I think you mentioned earlier. You could do Bluetooth.
Yeah.
And I think there are headphones that use all of them. Tell us about those different techniques. Which one does Sennheiser use, and which ones would you look for, and which ones would you avoid?
Well, I would avoid any of the infrared ones. Typically, for one, you can't walk out of the room that you're in if you use an infrared transmitter. And also, you tend to get noise from things like fluorescent lights and stuff like that, because it's sending the signal over light. So there tends to be some interference there. So I wouldn't use IR. FM, spread spectrum.
That's two.
I think it's not 900. I'm going to keep space well apart so I can hit them when
exactly,
I get to there.
Exactly, yes.
Spread spectrum, I think, is 900 megahertz, and it transmits actually at multiple wavelengths at the same time. And they're pretty good. So spread spectrum is fine. That's not a problem. Clear is the digital. I think it uses 900 megahertz as well, but it's a digital transfer. So it's full CD quality, 1644 digital audio. So you get very, very good transmission using Clear.
That's a digital transmission using RF radio frequency.
Right. And it's a branded, patented, I suppose. I don't know exactly what, but it's a chipset that manufacturers buy.
It's a proprietary thing from Sennheiser.
No, it's proprietary from Clear. K-L-E-E-R.
Oh. I'm sorry, yeah. Say that again.
K-L-E-E-R is the name of the company. And they do, for example, the Arcam R-Cube. It's a like a boom box. You can link six of them together and out on your patio and have like a whole outdoor system if you want. Or the point is they link together and they use Clear as well. So lot of people are using this Clear wireless transmission system for their high resolution digital audio purposes. And then of course there's wireless USB, the headphones that I'm using right now from Logitech use a USB wireless protocol. So I don't know much about it or what its range is. But and then there's, Bluetooth. Yeah. And then Bluetooth, of course, is generally speaking, it's a relatively short range. Really can't go too far, but probably a little bit out of the room that you're in. The thing about Bluetooth is there's so many protocols and there it's so complex. The variety of sound quality you can get from a Bluetooth transmission varies pretty widely. If you see something with what's called aptX on it, that's one of the latest high resolution versions.
aptX.
Yeah, apt-X.
I do know that Leo often when anybody calls him on the radio show and talks about Bluetooth audio, at least for music and so on, he always says that there's a profile called A2DP, I believe it is. Chat room, correct me if I'm wrong. Which sends stereo audio, in a much higher quality than the other standard one. I forget what it's called. That's only for like phone calls, for voice, which the quality doesn't really matter.
Right.
So that is aptX another one besides A2DP, or is it part of A2DP? Do you know?
No, I've been slowly but surely working my way up, trying to understand what's going on with Bluetooth, all I can say for sure is it's mighty complex. It may be two different aspects of the protocol structure, where. I know on my devices, you have this choice of saying, okay, I want to talk to this headphone like a headset, or I want to talk to this headphone like a headphone. And I think that's where that A2DP thing is. Is when you're talking it as a headphone, it's a stereo. Then there's the how much resolution is in that stereo stream, which I think is another, component of it. But I'm not really up to speed on that kind of stuff. It's pretty complex and evolving relatively rapidly.
Sure. Do you have any experience with listening to Bluetooth versus Clear versus FM regular analog? And do you have any sense of which one generally produces a better result?
Well, Clear is probably the best because it's a full blown, it's 1644, so it's CD quality. Then you're limited to the quality in the headphones, but the Sennheiser headphones are pretty good, so they're pretty good. The FM spread spectrum, that's number three,
very good.
It's usually pretty good. It can have a little bit of noise in it. Bluetooth is, I would say it's equivalent to, 328 KBS MP3 files, which I think is actually the one of the protocols. It does it as sends it as an MP3 stream, which is not as good as, CD rates, but it's very close. So The thing is that you tend to use them for different things. Although I have to say, I listen to Bluetooth headphones on my iPad quite often. I've really started to spend more time with Bluetooth headphones. And the problem, generally speaking, is as soon as you put active electronics inside headphones, the headphone makers can't resist turning up the bass. So
why is that, I wonder?
I don't know. As soon as they put some electronics in there, they tend to turn the bass up. I like the Sony MDR1R BT, MDR1R BT, which is their latest Bluetooth headset. It's a very, very nice headphone. Sounds pretty darn good. Very, very comfortable, very good looking headphone as well. So their Bluetooth implementation is pretty good. I enjoyed it quite a bit.
Beatmaster in the chat room is saying aptX is a codec, whereas A2DP is a protocol. So right. Thank you, Beatmaster, for clearing that up. That's very good. I also saw another comment in here about Sennheiser. Oh, from Beatmaster also. Sennheiser sells you almost all spare parts for a long time. And that's true. I've got an old pair of Sennheiser open headphones, their older style open headphones. And I was able to get ear pads for those, 20 years after I bought them.
HT580s, perchance?
They might very well be. They're actually sitting over there. I'll have to go look at them. But they could very well be. Yeah, they had the yellow foam open.
Oh, yeah, 414s.
414s, that's what it was. Yeah. Those are my first studio headphones, and I thought they sounded great.
For a lot of people, they were. I recently had a poll on my website. What was the most important headphone for headphone audiophiles and headphone enthusiasts? And really, it had more to do about the hobby, so I didn't include the 414. And I got a lot of comments that said you should have included the 414 because it was a very important headphone. But and it was. It was the first open ear pad style headphone. Great little head.
Yeah, I agree. Caffeine-free Dave in the chat room is saying, what about a low-power FM transmitter and clip a SanDisk Sansa clip with FM radio to your choice of headphones? So in other words, make any pair of headphones wireless. Have you ever tried anything like that?
I haven't done that, but I could get the duct tape out and we could certainly pull something like that off. There are though in the lower cost region, there are headphones that have FM radios in it, and in fact, have you ever seen those silent discos? Have you heard about this? It's kind of becoming fairly popular. Okay, so it's called a silent disco, and what they do is they have two DJs up on the stand spinning records, putting out music, but there's no speakers. Everybody listens on headphones, and they all have FM radios in the headphones. And they can choose. They have short-range FM transmitters at the venue where they're having this disco. And so you can tune in one DJ or the other. And they sort of have this contest because you can see the crowd dancing half of it to one beat and half of it to another beat. And you can see the crowd,
and you don't hear anything, but they're dancing away. No. That's amazing.
Yeah, and it's only started in the last couple of years. And if you Google headphone silent disco, they're popping up quite often now. I would say once every couple of months. Yeah,
that sounds somewhat like our engineer John's favorite band, Umphrey's McGee. He went and heard them recently, and they were doing a one-to-many headphone transmission as well. As I don't know if it was they had done that before or not, but they had one transmitter. They picked 16 or some number of fans. John was among them who got to wear these wireless headphones and hear the house mix in the headphones rather than coming from the PA system. And, that's not unlike what they want to do at the Twit Brick House, again, a one-to-many kind of transmission. So, John, there's another possibility. It's a little FM transmitter, maybe.
Sure. When I was in L.A. long, 40 years ago now or whatever, or almost 35 years ago now, a lot of times in the recording studios in L.A., they'll have a small FM transmitter in the parking lot in the back so that the producer could go hear the mix in his car because he was used to his car stereo.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Well, I certainly do know about when you're making a record or a CD or creating music, recorded music, you do want to play it on your car stereo and on some funky boombox, you know, to hear how the mix is going to sound in the real world. You know, when you're mixing in a studio, you've got beautiful speakers and great acoustics and everything. That isn't going to be how it's going to be listened to, though. So,
right. They used to have speakers called Auratones.
Yes, that were I remember.
Specially made to sound crappy.
Right, exactly. Well, let's see. I do have another question for you. Let's talk a bit about surround headphones.
Okay.
At CES, we heard the DTS made a big announcement about something called Headphone X, which is their answer, I think, more or less to Dolby Headphone, which is this synthesized surround in a pair of headphones. You know, it synthesizes the surround channels and the front channels, and it somehow synthesizes hearing sounds coming from these different directions. Headphone X now from DTS does much the same thing. I've done a show already on the Smith Realizer, which is sort of the ultimate in this sort of thing. What has your experience been with these surround synthesis systems for headphones?
Well, first, I didn't get a chance to hear the DTS. Well, I had the chance, but I didn't know about it for whatever reason. It never popped up on my radar before the show, so I didn't get a chance to see it. And in fact, I'm going to go down. Yeah, it's too bad. I'm going to go to the show in Newport, and I'm hopefully going to take an extra day and go over to DTS and have a demo of it and try to grill their engineers about it.
Good.
But I'm very, very skeptical. I've heard lots and lots and lots of these headphone virtualizers. The very first of these headphone virtualizer gadgets was made by, I think it was Altec, but it might have been JBL. I can't remember, but there was a guy named Ben Bauer, who was an engineer ages and ages ago, who made a passive one that you hooked up to a speaker power amplifier that you could drive headphones with. And this was in the 60s or something like that. But basically, if you have two speakers and you turn off the left speaker, the sound from the right speaker goes to the right ear and goes a little farther and crosses over to the left ear. So there's a little bit of a time delay. That's called the interaural time difference. Mm-hmm. That delay between what you hear in your left ear and your right ear is the main cue that you use to tell where a sound is coming from left to right. But there are many other cues. There's cues that happen on the pinna of your ear and the shape of the pinna of your ear. There's all sorts of echoes that come off your chest and things like that. So there's all sorts of timing cues that your ears hear from speakers that can be mapped out. And that's called the head-related transfer function. And because all our heads are a little bit different size and their pinnas are a little bit different shape, all of our head-related transfer functions are a little bit different, but the bottom line is that there is something called a head-related transfer function, and you can generalize it a little bit because people's heads and ears are roughly the same, you know, size and shape. Knowing those head-related transfer functions, it allows you to create artificial information in the signal that would give you the idea that you're listening to something that's coming outside your head as opposed to a pair of headphones. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out that it's extremely difficult to actually get it to sound like it's outside your head. And the main reason for that is that the cues that your brain listens to in order to localize sound it doesn't really listen to the cues alone. It listens to how the cues change when you move your head relative to the speakers. So it's actually head movement that allows you to lock into the spatial information and the sound around you. Now, of course, on headphones, when you move your head, your headphones move with you, and so you're not getting any localization cues. Of course, you don't get any crossover from the right speaker to the left ear and vice versa, and so headphones, you know, are without any of this processing, pretty poor at producing an image. But even when you do it very, very well, if you don't have that ability to change the cues with head movements, it's about only 1/10 as effective. There were studies done where they clamp people's heads in a darkened room, and they make sound come from different directions. And when the heads are clamped, the front to back reversals go up by a factor of 10, and their ability to localize sound is very, very much diminished. When you're allowed to move your head, you do a much better job. In fact, they let people wander in a dark room to try to find the source of a sound in a black room, and they put a head tracker on them. And what you see as they approach the target is they do this, they hunt with their head. Almost everybody does this. If they're looking for a sound in a black room, they'll move their head
back and forth.
Get the cues to change, you know, with their head movement like that. Also, they will not look directly at the sound source. They'll look down and to the side a little bit. And that's because directly in front is the hardest place to localize, which is, of course, where you want sound to localize in a home theater system. Right. So it's very, very difficult, and that's why the Smith Realizer does such a good job of localizing sound, or one of the reasons why it's able to do such a good job is that it's got a head tracker on it. So as you move your head, the cues move relative to
the orientation of your head. Yeah, exactly. Right. So with this head tracker function, if you imagine that you're listening to speakers outside of your head, as you move your head, the speakers don't seem to move. Whereas right. with it these seems, other virtualizers, they do. They move along right. with you.
Right. So it's like having your head clamped with most of them.
Right. Which, as you said, really reduces the ability to localize well.
Right, because the cues aren't changing. It's the changing of the cues that your head can hear, not the cues themselves.
Right. Well, what about then the idea of putting a bunch of drivers inside the headphones so that you don't virtually hear you're not having to recreate the head-related transfer function and so on. Maybe you still have to some degree. But you've actually got separate surround drivers in your headphones and front, right, and left. You couldn't have a center, obviously. It'd be sitting right in front of your head. But gamers use these a lot.
Yep.
That you'd still have the problem of moving your head from side to side. The speakers would move with you. But do you get any better sense of surround sound with multi-driver headphones like that?
Well... Well, back when I was in high school with quadraphonic headphones, I used to think so. But it may have been due to other factors. Yeah, I first of all, I haven't spent a lot of time with these multi-driver headphones. And the reason why is whenever I go to CES and I see a pair, I go over and listen, and they just sound like an abomination. Mm-hmm. So first of all, you would have to – I mean, it's hard enough to make a good, you know, accurate, resolving, non-resonant, you know, headphone that delivers good edges with one driver. Now to produce one with a bunch of drivers in there is – it, you know, just on the face of it, producing good audio in there would be hard. But there's another problem. And that other problem is sound doesn't propagate in headphones like it propagates – from a pair of speakers to your head. your readers or your viewers probably know about if you put a subwoofer in a room and the room is smaller than the lowest wavelength that you're going to be reproducing on the subwoofer, that you get some boundary gain. You get some extra gain in that frequency because of the enclosure that the room is relative to the size of the wavelength of the sound. Yep. Well, at 1,000 hertz, sound is about 1,000 feet per second. So the wavelength of sound is about 1 foot. And so the half wavelength at 1,000 hertz is 6 inches. So as soon as you get an enclosure smaller than 6 inches, you're going to get some gain at 1 kilohertz. You're going to affect the way that sound operates. And it really doesn't propagate anymore as much as it pressurizes the space that it's in. Well, I mean, there really isn't even 6 inches of space in a headphone. You'd be lucky to get 2 inches of space. So 2 inches of space would be on the neighborhood of 3,000
kilohertz.
Yeah, somewhere around. in that neighborhood.
Several
kilohertz. So up until 3 to 5K, audio doesn't even remotely, sound doesn't even remotely act like it's propagating through space. It acts like it's being coupled in a coupler. I don't know if you know much about waveguides, but waveguides are couplers, and so radar can move down a tube, an empty tube, and never touch the sides because of the geometry of it. Well, anyway, the point is that
same thing. The same technique, by the way, is used in some speakers as well. Waveguide,
sure.
Waveguides are attached to tweeters in particular, sometimes woofers. In order to manipulate the sound that way.
Yep. So the bottom line is that maybe at, 5K and above, sound maybe propagates normally. But then again, you have to remember that a driver, what the ear is used to hearing is a planar wavefront moving, approaching the ear from various angles. And so the cues that you're used to hearing are developed by the geometry of your ear and a flat wavefront hitting it. Now, of course, a dome driver looks like a point source some distance behind the driver, but tries to look like a point source, and it doesn't have a planar wavefront inside the headphone. So even when there is a wavefront propagating inside the headphones, it's rarely anything remotely planar. Now, there are planar headphones that's a different story, but they tend to image better. So the bottom line is that I think the acoustics pretty much prevents any possibility of acoustically reproducing a multi-driver environment or a multi-speaker environment like home theater. I think the way to do it is the way Smith has done it and the way Dolby has done it. Dolby's Dolby headphone is pretty good. I like it. I can, after a while, ignore some of its artificialness and enjoy the movie quite a bit. So I think the solution to these problems is to have very accurate headphones and then throw a lot of digital signal processing at it. And then if you really want to get it right, get a head tracker on there and have the virtualized speakers, remain in one place.
Remain
as your head
location. Right. Yeah, caffeine-free Dave in the chat room asks, but with a picture just in front of you, why is the headphone moving thing you're talking about such a big deal? And I think I'd like you to answer that, but I would conjecture that even with the picture in front of you and you're sitting there watching a movie, I bet you're still moving your head around a little bit, unconsciously.
Yep. You still move your head around a little bit. Subconsciously, the visual system takes precedence over the auditory system, so it will tend to, at least subconsciously, force the image to remain where the speaker is, even if you move your head a little bit. So it is a bit of a tricky thing when you start talking about a visual information and the audio information at the same time. But right. Bottom line is that your hearing system is exquisite, and even small changes of head position are enough to change the cues enough for you to improve your localization. Mm-hmm. I'll give you another thing that's similar to that. The Dolby headphone system, one of the things that you're able to control is the size of the room. So the Dolby headphone system not only synthesizes the placement of speakers around you, but also synthesizes the reflections off walls. And they synthesize the sound from a small, medium, and a large room. And sometimes you can get this cognitive dissonance between the Dolby headphone setting that you're on and the actual room that you're in. So So when you see the room you're in, you expect it to be a certain size, and you somehow sort of expect it to have a certain sound. And then when you have the sound from the Dolby headphone system, you can tell that it's not, doesn't really quite match. And there's a bit of a cognitive disconnect, but most of that stuff disappears rather rapidly as you take your attention away from it.
Sure, as you're watching a movie or something.
Yeah.
Well, you haven't heard the DTS Headphone X yet, and I really look forward to hearing what you think about it. I did hear it at CES, and I was quite impressed. It really felt like the speakers were outside of the headphones.
Did they play any programmatic material like movies or music or anything like that?
No, that was the weird thing about it. As far as I can recall, it was only, this is front left, this is front right, this is center. You know, basically a voice telling you which speaker things were coming out of. Yeah. I don't recall hearing any real program material.
Yeah. It's easier to do when you do that.
And once again, we get a trade show demo optimized for what the thing does well.
Yeah. For example, there's some recording that people famously hear a dog bark in this recording, and it sounds like it's coming from behind them. Because it's a voice or because it's a dog, you actually expect it to be real as opposed to the programmatic material that you're listening to. And you hear this dog or a door slam or a person's voice in the background of music or something like that, and you'll turn around and look for it. And almost always you localize rearward. As I said, it's harder to localize in front than in back. So if there's an odd sound in a recording like that, a dog bark or a door slam, or people will turn around and look for it. So they're kind of taking advantage of that by using a voice or a dog bark or something like that. And it's much easier to fake your head out that way.
Right, right.
And especially rearward as well.
I'm looking for, here it is. Web3151 in the chat room is pointing to a product by Turtle Beach, USB-powered Dolby surround sound processor that claims to, quote, transform your stereo headset or headphones into Dolby surround sound, which is a Turtle Beach. So that might be something worth checking out.
Yeah, I can't remember the model number. I can't remember the model number of the ones I'm wearing, but it has Dolby surround in it too, and it's a USB headset.
Hmm. Okay, well, I've got a question here. Oh, by the way, just before we leave the topic of surround headphones, if you ever get a chance, I don't know if you go to Cedia or not this coming September. It's held in September. This company, Mosaics, which does media servers, introduced last year at Cedia a discrete driver, multi-channel headphone. Big old cans. I mean, big, giant thing sitting on your ears. Looked like Princess Leia for sure. with discrete drivers and very fancy, very expensive. To tell you the truth, I wasn't that impressed. And the they claim to have subwoofers too in there. And those things with the low frequencies, they kind of really rattled.
I just today saw a blurb on I can't remember what they called it. They may have started a Kickstarter project sometime soon. Whack pack or something like that. But it's a backpack that has a subwoofer in it that pounds you on the back.
oh, that's pretty weird.
And, Yeah, and by the way, I did see that the headphone that you're talking about. I think you mentioned it in an email to me, and I've marked it, so I'll try to get my hands on it. But yeah. Again, you know, putting so many drivers in a pair of headphones is hard.
Yeah.
It's so hard to make a regular two-channel headphone sound good. It's hard enough that right. Putting, you know, three or four or five, forget it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, let's take the last part of the show here to talk about two-channel headphones. I've got a question here in the chat room from Undermind, who's in the market for a pair of sealed over-the-ear headphones to replace his Sony MDR-7506s. Yeah. He was considering the Heil ProSet 3, which I'm wearing now, and any suggestions in the price limit or in the price range around $350. Don't plan on using a separate amp or DAC for a while. We're going to talk about amps or DACs as well, but what would you say to this guy in terms of $350 headphones to replace his Sony MDR-7506s?
I absolutely love the Sennheiser Momentum. I'm sounding like a Sennheiser fanboy this show so far. we'll have to find a way to get away from that. But
yeah,
it's
and
not
actually
easy.
You're not alone. Archagon in the chat room also mentions Sennheiser Momentums.
Yeah, they're a fabulous headphone. The one problem is that their ear cup is quite small. So a lot of people, if you have even somewhat above average sized ears, your ears won't fit inside the cup. So it's a little tough to make the recommendation, but it's the best sealed headphone that I'm aware of. And it's right at $349. So, that's a very, very good headphone. As an alternative, if your ears are big, I'd recommend the Sony MDR-1R. It's not as neutral sounding. It's a little bit uneven, but boy, they are terribly comfortable. Very, very good looking, and pretty good sounding. So the Sony MDR-1R is quite good, and the Sennheiser Momentum is just out of this world.
Yeah, Archagon also mentioned the Sony MDR-1R, as well as the Logitech UE6000. Have you tried those?
The UE6000 is a good headphone. It's a I can't remember if that's the noise canceller or the – I think that's the noise canceller, and then there's a 9000, which is the Bluetooth. When you turn it on active, it doesn't sound very good. Again, the bass gets boosted. But passively, the UE6000 is a great sealed headphone for the price. It's a little rolled off on top, though. It lacks a little bit of articulation and clarity in the treble, but just a little bit. They're quite good, very, very good.
What about the Vmoda M100, another one Archagon mentions?
Yeah, he must read Interfidelity, I'll bet you. These have all been reviewed recently. Well, and they're all hot headphones out there right now. The Vmoda M100 is a great basshead headphone. And also very, very nicely built. There's a lot of great features about the Vmoda M100, but it's for bass heads. It's not for somebody who wants something neutral. Mm. Similarly, though not sealed, there's a new headphone, the Philips X1, which is also sort of a bass head headphone, but it does it better than any other bass head headphone that I've heard. Because it's an open headphone, it's very linear. So it's like a frequency response is just tilted. It's fairly flat, just tilted. Bass head headphones are bumpy.
Got it.
Yep.
I have to ask you also, Archagon also mentions probably my favorite headphone of the moment, which I can't say I have nearly the experience you do with headphones, but from what I've heard, I really, really like listening to the PSB M4U, which comes in two varieties. First came out with the M4U2, which was a noise canceler, which you could turn off.
Right.
And then the M4U1, which isn't a noise canceler, doesn't have a switch. It's just a passive headphone, but otherwise the same. I love listening to that headphone. What do you think of it?
I think they're a little edgy sounding. I'm quite opposed to anything that has any, you know, sort of edginess to it. And measurements show a bit of a overly zealous spike at the leading edge of the square waves on those headphones. He's still playing around with them, though. And he's not the only one. They're all manufacturers play around with headphones. and they end up changing over time. But that said, I thought they're fairly good. It's tough in the competitive world that's out there right now for somebody like PSB to actually make a dent in the marketplace, because so much is based on fashion and marketing sense and celebrity endorsement and stuff like that. And the Sennheiser Momentum and the Sony MDR-1R are such good looking headphones. And then the PSBs are a little boxy looking. So
they're pretty big and clunky. I agree.
Yeah. They're kind of big and clunky looking. And I think that's going to make it hard for them to push out there, but the sound is fairly good. I'll go along with that, but I can't put them right up there in the best of the best.
Got it. Somebody else here had another suggestion I wanted to get your feeling about, but of course it might have jumped away from me. They were here it is. Audio-Technica ATH WS-77 or WS-99. This was from Aphex. Question for the bass head masses. You were talking about bass heads. Audio-Technica ATH WS-77 or WS-99 versus the Sony XB lineup.
You know, I have to say, I'm afraid I haven't heard the first ones you're talking about, and then the XB Sonys have just refreshed their line with a new set, and I haven't gotten a chance to hear those either yet. So, I'm afraid I'm not up to speed on those particular models. Although, the Audio-Technica ATH. Too many model numbers.
Too many models.
No, there's a couple of fairly good bass headphones out there from Audio-Technica.
I got to tell you, man, I get people are quite impressed often with how many model numbers I know, and certainly I'm impressed with how many model numbers you know. But none of us can know all of them. There are so many of them.
No, and headphones these days are just through the roof in terms of the volume of product that's out there. I mean, it's just really. The number of headphones that are appearing is staggering, although I think it's slowing down relative to maybe a year ago. But still, the number of headphones is unbelievable. And in fact, we've seen the first headphone company wash out of the marketplace because it's just too hectic. A company called Audeo, it's actually their parent company is Phoniac. It's a European hearing aid manufacturer, and they made a little in-ear headphone called the Perfect Fit and the Perfect Bass headphone. And they were quite good, but they just couldn't get any traction with how crazy the market is right now. So they just bailed, you know. So I think we can expect to see people going out, getting back out of the headphone business over the next three or four years.
We're going to see some attrition. We're going to see some attrition as the market saturates.
Yeah. Well, I hate to say it, but Beats still has 64% of the over $100 headphone market.
Wow. And you were not really impressed with them as a quality product, right?
No.
Yeah.
Not for sound quality.
That's what I mean. Yeah. somebody here, Vince in the chat room, can you ask about the buyer dynamic head zone?
Head zone amplifier. Well, I do. I just measured it. I've been working on developing an automated. I do automated headphone measurements, and so now I've been working on automating my amplifier measurements so that I can produce a database of headphone amplifier measurements. And the head zone measures fairly well, but it has what I consider a fatal flaw in that it has a 100-ohm output impedance. And
most headphones are what, 600?
Most headphones, nowadays, those Momentums that I told you about are a 30-ohm or a 25-ohm headphone.
Oh, they're very low.
Yeah, headphones are impedances are getting lower and lower and lower so that they could be used with easily with portable devices. The problem is that it screws up the damping factor. I'm sure many of your viewers know about the damping factor, which is the difference in the impedance of the headphone and then the impedance or the speaker and then the output impedance of the driving device. And you want that to be at least 8 to 1. So if you have an 80 ohm headphone, you want at least at most a 10 ohm output on the headphone amplifier
You want the headphones to be eight times more impedance on their input as the amplifier has on its output.
Right. And I would say you should look, if you're looking for a headphone amplifier, look for a headphone amplifier that has 2 ohms or less output impedance. Now, the problem is that quite a few of them are in the 2 to 5 ohm output impedance range, which with some of these new headphones that are 20 ohms and even lower, even then don't have quite the damping factor that I'd like to see. But nonetheless, you want a low output impedance. Well, there's this holdover in Europe in the IEC specification. It's been in there for ages and ages. Back in the day, 30 years ago, when you had a headphone jack on a receiver, it typically was just a resistor in series with the output of the power amplifier. And they, to knock the power down and knock the noise down. And so typically they put like a 100 ohm, 120 ohm resistor in there in series with the output of a power amplifier to knock its voltage down and call it good. And that was the headphone jack. And that was so common that they wrote into the specification that when you measured headphones, you did so with 120 ohm output impedance. And that's the way you would characterize them. Well, that number is still in the specification, even though certainly enthusiast headphone amplifiers have much, much lower output impedances. As I say, 5 ohms or less very commonly and 2 ohms or less a lot of the times. But for whatever reason, Beyer doesn't seem to have bought into the idea that a good damping factor is a good idea. And they've for as long as I've been around, have always said, no, 120 ohms is the way to go. And because it's in the spec, and I think it's just wrong. Anyway, the Headzone has a 100 ohm output impedance, and I just don't think it's a good idea to have that kind of output impedance.
Now, just want to get a couple of terms defined. One is damping factor. Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you want the output impedance of the amp to be an eighth or so of the input impedance of the headphone. Damping factor to me seems like it would mean, that it's able to damp the motion of the headphones. What is the result of having a good or a bad damping factor?
Well, basically, when you drive the driver in the headphone, which is a little coil typically with an electrical signal, it impedes changes in that electrical signal in two ways. One is, let's say you start pushing a signal through the coil. Now a magnetic field has to build up around the coil. So as you try to put energy in there, some of that energy is going into building up the magnetic field around the driver. Then when you reverse the direction of the signal, what happens is that magnetic field collapses, and when it collapses, it tries to drive a signal of the direction that it was charged with. So this expanding and collapsing magnetic field around the coil is almost always opposing the change that you want to make. So that impedance is, and that's why you call it reactive. There's resistance and reactance, and that's the reactive component of a driver is this magnetic field. Then there's also the motion of the coil through the magnet, and which creates energy. Well, so both the collapsing field and the motion of the driver create what's typically called back electromotive force or counter electromotive force. And this counter electromotive force, it's essentially like the headphone is acting as a microphone. And as you well know, many headphone makers also make microphones because microphone diaphragms and headphone diaphragms are very, very similar.
So, sure, Beyerdynamic is one of them.
But Audio-Technica, Sennheiser, I mean, yep. a lot of AKG, a lot of the big makers of headphones also make microphones because the dynamic diaphragms and dynamic microphones are quite similar. Well, anyway, so here's the point. The point is that you're driving the headphones with the signal, but there's also a signal coming back from the headphones. And the only place it has to go is back into the amplifier. Now, if the amplifier has a high output impedance, that current coming back from the headphones will be allowed to generate some voltage across the output impedance of the amplifier. Mm. And as soon as it does that, then that electromotive force gets to have its way to some extent. But if you have the output impedance of the amplifier is, let's say, 0 ohms, it's possible to get quite close to 0 ohms.
You can't really get there, but you can get close.
Well, the point is like a short. So any of the counter electromotive force from the headphones gets shorted out. And therefore, it's only the drive signal that's having an effect on the headphones. So that's the damping that it does. It shorts out the counter electromotive force to some extent.
Got it.
And there is no hard line, but the number I've always heard is 10 to 1, but lately I've started hearing 8 to 1. I don't think it really matters very much, but it's somewhere in that neighborhood. So if you have a 30-ohm headphone, you want a 3-ohm output impedance. 600-ohm headphone, you can have a 60-ohm output impedance. And when you're talking about an output transformerless tube amplifier that's going to have in the tens of ohms output impedance, then you want to use a very high impedance headphone. And that's why Sennheiser HD600s are a great choice, for example, for the Bottlehead Crack or the Woo Audio WA3. These are both output transformerless tube amplifiers. Mm-hmm. And so you use high impedance headphones so you get a good damping factor.
Great. Wonderful explanation. Thank you. Lawn Dog is asking to explain the term you used earlier with regard to the PSB headphones, edginess.
Oh, well, that's related to zazziness or
really, you know, it's an emphasis on the high frequencies, right?
Etched. Yeah. It's edginess. It's a harshness. You know, you can put it that way too. Just something grindy, grating, you know, piercing in your ears, something that causes your ears to, you know, to flinch. Typically, it manifests as in my square wave measurements as the front edge of the square wave ringing a lot for some reason, or having a lot of overshoot, that it goes high, much higher than the top of the square wave.
Okay. JPL4 in the chat room is reminding me that Leo Laporte wanted me to ask you about a company called German Maestro.
Yeah.
You know them?
I do. I saw them at the last CES and listened to their headphones, and they were okay. There was a couple that were actually fairly good. But I haven't gotten any headphones from them.
So you don't really have any direct experience other than at a trade show, which you can hardly make any kind of determination there. Yeah. F-Loop in the chat room is asking, seems like there are hundreds of reasonably priced headphones that never get talked about. I just lost it here. Like the Heil ones I'm wearing, for example. Is it likely that there are some unmined gems in the bunch? Headfi.org, I think it is another headphone website, seems to circle around the same couple dozen cans with little new discovery. What do you think about that?
Well, I think actually Headfi does a pretty good job of discovering headphones out there that are off the beaten track. So it does happen that, you know, people it takes a little while. Again, there is the problem of there being a bajillion headphones out there.
Yeah.
And there is absolutely no doubt that there's gold nuggets amongst them. But whether they're actually, finding them is tough because there's so many. But for instance, not long ago, I reviewed a headphone called the Noontech, Noontec Zoro, Zoro. And it's a $65 headphone. It's basically a Chinese knockoff of the Monster, the Beats Solo and Zoro.
Not so subtle a knockoff, obviously.
No. And although they're a little bit different in the shape on the outside, but they're quite a bit better sounding. And I mean substantially better sounding. They're quite good sounding. Cost Porter Pros are, they're a great sounding little headphone. But it's true. There's probably quite a number of good headphones, good cheap headphones by no name companies out there. But I would say it's like 1 in 100, So for every 100 headphones that are just horrible, there's one that's good. And it wasn't designed to be good. They just got lucky. it's monkeys writing Shakespeare at that point.
Well, we'll talk about that maybe another time. We're almost out of time here. Dr. T has a quick question. Do you review headphones listening to an iPhone or some portable player as part of your review process?
If it's a headphone that is that would be intended to use on a phone, sure. I listen to headphones using a number of different amplifiers and then no amplification at all. I have an iPhone and a Galaxy S3, and I'll switch it up. I'll use it in all the different ones. So Sure, you bet.
Last question from Spin Dizzy in the chat room. Are the benefits of headphone break-in a myth, a reality, overrated?
Overrated. I did an experiment one time, or I went off to CES, and while in my chamber, I had a pair of headphones on a head playing Pink Noise, and then every hour it would do a characterization. It would do a frequency response and impulse response and a couple of other things. And there was an observable trend over that time of lowering harmonics. Distortion harmonics, but a very slight amount. I would say that headphones do break in a little bit, and I think it comes from the stresses when you stamp the diaphragm. It has all these little ridges and crinkles in it that act like live hinges. When you stamp the diaphragm in the material, you induce stresses, and they heat the tools to do this to reduce the stresses that are in there. But nonetheless, there'll be some stresses in there. And that over time, as you drive the diaphragm, these live hinges will work out the stresses that are in them and be a little more linear. You can imagine if you have a live hinge that's circular in shape and there's a little more stress in one side than the other, that it could angle a little bit as it gets driven. But I'm just grasping at straws there. I think headphones do break in a little, and I have heard it, I believe, but I think it's strongly overrated. And I always burn in headphones when I get them. I've got a system that just runs Pink Noise all the time, and I just plug headphones into it. But I've never really heard much of a difference before and after I put the headphones on the burn-in system. By far, the biggest thing that burns in is your head getting used. No, I'm deadly serious too. It's your head's getting used to the headphones that is the biggest thing.
Right. Okay. One final question. Sorry, okay, go ahead.
Well, when I worked at Headroom, this is back in the day when most people only had one pair of headphones and they were looking to upgrade. And we would sell them a headphone that we thought was superior to what they had, and they would get it. And then every once in a while, you get somebody to call and says, "Oh, this headphone sounds much worse than my headphones." And we ask them what headphones they have, and they said, and it would be obvious, no, this person hasn't heard it enough. And so what we said was, you have 30 days to return the product. Don't listen to your original headphones. For the next 3 weeks, just listen to the new headphones. And then at the end of that 3 weeks, then you can switch back and forth. And invariably, and I mean not once did it ever happen that that person didn't call back and go, "Oh, yeah, these are much better. I just had to get used to them." So it's your head getting used to them.
Yeah, yeah. One final quick question. Of the headphones you've listened to lately and reviewed, what are your favorites?
Wow. I mean, it's hard. I have to rattle off a few because headphones are in categories. Okay. So
yeah, that's fine.
I love the Sennheiser Momentums. I love the Philips X1 for a bass head headphone. I absolutely love the Jerry Harvey JH13 Freak Phase, the time-aligned in-ear, custom in-ear monitor. I love the Stax 009 electrostatic headphone. It's absolutely fabulous. And then just to throw an oddball one in, I'm going to give another shout-out to the Koss Porter Pro Jr. It's been around for 30 years or something like that. It's still the best $29, $39 you can spend in headphones. So those
fantastic.
Are great.
Good deal. Well, Tile, thank you so much. Great hour of conversation and not the last, I'm sure.
What happened to the advertisement in the middle? I was expecting it all the way along.
Sadly, we have no advertisement today. I wish we did. Believe me, I wish we did. But we didn't, so we got to talk the whole time.
Well, that's cool. Well, it was a pleasure being with you, Scott, of course, as always.
As always. Thank you so much. You can read all about Tile's work with headphones at his website, innerfidelity.com. You can find me at avsforum.com and also at hometheaterhifi.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv, and you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott. And you can always find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks at twit.tv/htg or its new YouTube channel, youtube.com/twit/HomeTheaterGeeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be Ron Williams and Jeff Tully, both industry consultants who will have just returned from the NAB show in Las Vegas, which is going on as we speak right now. They're going to give us their impressions of what they saw there at the National Association of Broadcasters show, which I'm sure will be full of 4K and related news like that. So I do hope you will join me. Until then, geek out.